Good afternoon. I think it's time to start. I sent out a notice that we put up the first three lectures, the audio copies of the lectures, on the class webpage. So you're able to listen to that if you care to. I found out by just listening to them that I always seem to start lectures with the words okay. So I made a conscious effort to try to break the habit today. I also found, maybe some of you did too, that it's always strange hearing yourself on audio. The voice you hear through your skull is rather different. So I always thought that, you know, that my voice was a tenor. And if you're into opera, that's great, because being a tenor is the guy that always gets the soprano and is happy at the end. The somewhat deeper voice is normally a baritone, and baritones don't nearly as well. A great example is Don Giovanni is a baritone who does terrible things. And does anybody know enough about opera about what happens to Giovanni at the very end? Some demons come up and drag him down to hell, and not the best ending, even if you're there. So I don't know. Maybe I'll still think in my mind, if I had any voice at all, I'd still like to be a tenor, but maybe I have to be a baritone. Thank goodness I'm not likely to be a countertenor, which is voice. Does anybody know what a countertenor is? It's a man, essentially, who has a soprano voice. So if you want to dress up like a lady and sing soprano, a male who's a countertenor can do it, but not so great on that. So at any rate, it turns out when I was driving in to the job today, there was a little announcement about a town in central New York called Ithaca, New York. And that ran near and dear to my heart because that's where I went to school, Cornell University. And apparently all cities, towns, municipalities have a website these days that says, come and visit, it's a great place, come and spend your money. But apparently they've had such a bad winter in that area of the Northeast that they essentially popped up a menu says, we're frozen solid, go to Key West and don't think of coming here until next spring when we all thaw out. And I was thinking Madison, if they had any honesty, might want to do a similar thing, or maybe Verona. Oh, there goes my, come on, come back to life. See, I always know when I'm talking too long because it blanks out. See if we can get her to come back. There we go, cool. So a couple of announcements and apropos to what people have been asking me in office hours and the rest. In fact, in office hours yesterday, I noticed the building was, or at 5 o'clock, was very busy. The parking lot was all mostly filled and most of the rooms were active. Do you folks celebrate President's Day or what? What was there something magic yesterday?
It was a home day.
A what day? Oh, okay. I was wondering that situation here that I checked my watch to see if I'd come in too early or something. Cardinal sin for an instructor who's come in early and have to waste time. So at any rate, I had a couple of questions last time, and I think many of you have similar concerns that I'll get to. One of those is I'm going to give you an example of something I put together in JLEX that's real handy for testing simple regular expressions. The trouble is, as you're building an analyzer, sometimes the program gets bigger and bigger, and you just want to focus on one little problem. And oftentimes in debugging, the smaller you can make your test case, the better off you are in isolating what's going wrong. And I'll show you about that. It turns out also, later this week, I'll be giving a written homework on some of the stuff I'll talk about today, some of the theoretical issues of how in the world do scanners actually work? How do they take these silly regular expressions and build something that actually is programmable and operable? And we'll be talking about that for most of today's lectures. There'll be a homework on that, and at least a couple of parts of the homework will be, write me a regular expression that does this or that. In fact, one of them I'll give you a heads up on, and it's something that I'm sure you thought about, namely the famous slash star, star slash comment that appears in lots of languages, C, C++, Java, C#, other languages too. And it ought to be something that's reasonably easy to do. It's not as easy as you would like, but it's something that basically I'll say, write me one of those that works. And you can write it down and scratch your head and say, yeah, that looks like it works. But sometimes looking at a program and saying it ought to work and really believing it does work are two different things. And one of the things that this tester can do is you can take your solution, put it in there, and try some oddball combinations of things that ought to work and ought not to work. So, for example, it ought to be the case that you can't have a star slash in the middle of a comment. We had a similar thing in some discussion on Piazza today about isolated pound signs. And it's a similar thing here. So you ought to test that if you try to do this, what you would expect would happen is the scanner would stop at that. And then presumably the rest of this would be misscanned. And we'll talk about how you could perhaps identify that and what you would do in response to an error situation. But I just wanted to point out that having something that tests regular expressions is great, because sometimes when you write something down, and I'll show examples of something that look plausible, but maybe they don't quite work, it's always better to put it through a system. And if it says it works, you tried some things and they're accepted, other things like this are either rejected or misscanned, depending on how you want to approach it, that would give you much more confidence that what you have is, if not correct, pretty darn close to correct. Of course, we want totally correct, but sometimes finding subtle errors that, yeah, it looks like it ought to disallow this or not, but it turns out it actually does accept something unexpectedly. That then means go back to your definition and try again. So let me just get over to that. Here we are. And I'll show you where to find this. It's available on the class webpage. But basically, this thing is called Regular Expression Tester. And as the name suggests, it tests regular expressions. Now, what I have in here today is something that many of you are worrying about, namely, the hardest token of the bunch in our current project is quoted strings. And quoted strings are hard because not only do you have to match up the quotes, but it also has some inclusion rules and some exclusion rules. The exclusion rules say thou shalt not have unprintables inside the body. If you write down too simple a definition, it may allow that. It also says thou must allow certain combinations in a restricted form, and those things are like escaped. So I can't have a singleton slash, something just like this, sitting in the middle of a string, unless the next character is one of the special characters. Remember, you're allowed to have backslash new line, backslash tab, double backslash, and backslash double quote. Those are ways to escape these magic characters. Two of them are so that you can have a single backslash in the string or single double quote in the string body, or you can write down a tab or a new line in a visible form rather than invisible form. So basically what happens is I have a very simple little definitional area, and is the projection good enough that you can begin to read this or not? I'm not sure. Let's see if this takes Command Shift Plus to make it bigger. See if I can make the font bigger here. Excuse me? Oh, I hate to do that. I always get it screwed up. So I know what we'll do. We got paper here, and I'll just write down what we're looking at right here. So basically what happens is it has one test line, which is number 18. Okay. And now what do I do? Hold control. Okay, I'm holding control or command. I'm on an Apple. Okay. No. I'm say that again? Oh, cool. Okay. Things do change, don't they? Under general? Appearance? You got to help me on this. I've not done this part before. Where's the font control? Excuse me? Under what? Oh, colors and fonts, dummy. Yeah, thank you. Basic. I tried that. That's a standard one. Oh, no, I'm sorry. No, it's not. Option command shift plus. Option command equals. Let's get out of this thing.
It's only working for his computer.
What system are you running? Yeah, well, Mac, what Mac? I mean, what version? I've got Yosemite. So option command equal does nothing. Huh? Okay, let's go back in. So anyway, I can write down what the pattern is, and we'll be able to see what's going on. The important part of this is that I've got something that automatically matches illegal characters for you. And what happens is sometimes if you have illegal characters, the scanner will simply terminate you out with an unexpected input. So basically, here's the input I'm trying to work with. And this is just a starter for a comment. There we go. So anything that's not a double quote. Wait a minute, I've got a star and I don't want that. Okay. Close star. So this is the basic trying to match double quotes, and in the body, I can't have a double quote, so I exclude that and repeat that. And now let's see if that thing works as expected. So I'll go ahead and tell it to build it. We'll better save. Yeah, okay, and let's look at my test input here. So if you look at the bottom here, it matched ABC and then matched three consecutive backslashes, which it shouldn't have, but that's because I don't have the backslash management in there. And it did something pretty strange that I'm trying to set up for later lecture today. Namely, it matched hi there, but on two lines. Remember, what we had in mind was that right here, that we didn't want to have strings cross line boundaries. And now you can start to understand why. It looks pretty bogus in terms of, in this case, exactly what's in the string. Is there a hi with there immediately following it, or a new line, or blanks, or tabs, or whatever? So one of the reasons about not allowing unprintables is it's hard from reading the source to understand exactly what the programmer intends to have in there. So that was our output, and notice that is entirely consistent with match double quotes, and anything that's not a double quote. So let's look at our input and call that test file. Excuse me? Oh, we're going to move that up, sorry. There we go. So what our input was ABC, which was matched precisely, and we're up top here, and then three consecutive backslashes, which were matched because it turns out there was nothing in our definition that talked about backslash as being special. This backslash is a way of escaping the double quote. And it accept hi there with the new line as part of the body because, again, there was nothing inside the definition that said thou shalt not have an unprintable. So this is the stage where I'm starting to do my definition and I want to do some inclusions or exclusions. And I think this is a good way to play in isolation with the definition. So what I do now is I simply go back to my ex.jlex, which is the example.jlex, and start playing with the sucker a bit. So in this particular case, I might say, well, let's get my cursor right, that I excluded the new line. I may also want to exclude, as an example of an unprintable, I excluded the double quote. I want to exclude the new line. So I simply say backslash new line. So now I'm inside here. I'm saying thou shalt not have / new line. Remember, / n in a character class represents the unprintable / a new line character, not the two characters. So I save that guy and rerun. Oh, and now I thought I made progress, but actually now it looks like I've done worse. And that'd be part of today's lecture. It did worse because I excluded something, but I excluded something that's problematic. So the question is, it matched ABC. That's fine. I expected it should continue to do that. So I have one test just for normal kind of strings. It is handling / as if they were ordinary characters, because I haven't told it it's not anything other than an ordinary character. But I've excluded my multi-line comment. But look at the error message I got. And this is essentially what a scanner, without any special intervention on your part, would give out. It said, okay, double quote was bad. Okay, fine. And now because I don't have any definitions of reserved words or identifiers, the hi there is going to be scanned as individual characters, which are rejected. But notice from the programmer's point of view, this is a terrible set of error messages because it's suggesting I have 10 errors. And I don't have 10 errors. I probably have one error, which we all know what it is. Namely, I try to have a multi-line string with my language definition, and now my token definition disallow it. So when you go ahead and put this fix in, and you ran something like this, which is clearly erroneous, the standard default error handling, what is that? That's normally scan as far as you can. If you can't scan the next character, call it bogus, print out some error message. I did that. It's not great, but it's close enough. Illegal double quote. Oh, that's bad. Why is double quote illegal? Isn't that what we do strings on? So all of a sudden the user, particularly if he or she is not experienced, is being misled. Something is wrong, but it's wrong not because double quote is bad, but because it was part of a long token which was almost but not quite correct. So what I'll be talking deeper in today's lecture is a way to exclude this, because the rules are you must, but also to print out an error message that gives the user at least enough insight to say, here's what you did wrong, and you have to fix it. So presumably in this case, you'd either put in a /n, which allows to have it in there, or perhaps break the string into two pieces and have line one be one string and have line two be another string. Either way. So you as a programmer could fix it if you knew why the language was unhappy. This does not tell you that, but it does not tell you that because it doesn't have definitions for what's illegal. Anything that's not legal is illegal. But we all know in real life there's all these kind of middle section here where things are a little iffy and so on. And we are sort of like the traffic cops. And that's always a great analogy. You read a sign and says speed limit 35 miles per hour or 40 miles per hour. Most of you have cars now. Is that really the truth? If it says the speed limit is 35 miles per hour and you go 36, unless you're in a place like Rosendale, which is known as a speed trap center of Wisconsin, what's going to happen if you go 36 in a 35 mile per hour zone? Almost certainly nothing. 40, you're probably okay. My rule of thumb is 10 miles per hour. Then you're getting iffy. Certainly if you go 60 in a 35 mile per hour zone and you go past the cop, you're in trouble. So it turns out that the rules are actually implemented by cops, or in our case, by compiler writers. And sometimes those are context sensitive. I gave the story one time, and a fellow came up here, and he raised his head and says, I got a speeding ticket, and I was only four or five miles above the speed limit. So I asked him, what kind of car did he have? A Camaro. What color was it? Red. And everybody knows that a sporty car that's red automatically seems to be going faster than it is. That's why if you have the money and the inclination to buy one. But one of the downsides of that is you probably get more tickets than you would if you were driving some old Chevy or something that barely can go the speed limit and not much above it. So at any rate, I wanted to show you this, that it was available. Let me actually get out of this thing so you don't go blind and go back and show you where to find it, but it's an easy thing to find. So it's on our old class webpage under programming assignments and homeworks. And it's in the same spot where I put the other Eclipse archive. I just made an archive. So along with the startup, which most of you have gotten for Project 2, there's this thing which got a little truncated, but it's the same thing I just showed you. And you can just download that, unzip it, and it's a very simple thing to use. And it's great if you're trying to debug one regular expression in isolation. So if you wrote down what you thought was a good definition for strings or quoted characters, and by gosh, it's not working, sometimes it's good to work backwards. Say, let's try something that's simple and kind of works, like I just showed you, and then add this and add this. And if you add and delete enough stuff, you got the solution. And then you wire it back into the main program, and away you go. So you don't have to do this, but I think it's a nice thing to know about, and I wanted to show you that. So let's go back to this guy and come, come, come. Oh. I've got Acrobat installed, and for some reason it's mucho slow, and it changes things. Ah, and it comes back. So this is where we ended last time. And this was a sort of situation there. I brought this up because in a little bit later we're going to talk about the fact that although end the file is not normally a character, in some cases it's useful to be able to treat it almost as if it was a character. You don't have to do it, but if it were a available, it might be handy. And I'll show you examples of how you might write a definition using and then the file symbol. But since it doesn't exist, you have to find some other alternative. It doesn't exist because most ASCII character sets does not have that as a special character. Remember, what happens is in I/O, typically there's a condition you can test. You can ask a predicate, am I at end the file or not? An alternative would be to actually give you an end the file character. And in fact, there are some very low level input routines in Java that do just that. And there's a cognate in C also. So it says input stream read, which would normally give you an ASCII character. But end the file is not an ASCII character. But what it does is it ends up giving you a byte minus one, which is kind of strange because you don't normally think of bytes as being signed. But since there are only 128 ASCII characters in an 8-character representation, the leftmost bit is always zero, which means that it's essentially plus or zero. So a minus one would have that bit set to a one, and it would give you the ability to have extra characters if you wanted them. I'm not saying you should program it this way. I'm just simply saying that at a low level, you have to deal with the fact that sometimes it'd be nice if end the file were an honest to gosh character. Because then I just write, I have a pattern, just like I have a backslash new line or a backslash tab, I might have maybe a backslash E for end the file. I think maybe backslash E is taken, but if it is, I don't know for what. It's not a very important character. So what we do instead is end the file is automatically handed by the scanner. And as I said last time, the scanner can act as if it would read an end the file, not to match end the file per se, but to realize that it's run out of characters. An example of that would be if I had a file whose very last lines were something like A, B, C, and here's this precipice of nothing left. It's the void, thou shalt not be. Notice the scanner is trying to read as many characters as possible to make the longest possible valid token. So it would read A, B, C, and then it would try to read another character. And it has to be programmed carefully enough that says, hey, there are no more characters, so what's your next character is not going to be a letter, because there are no more characters and hence no more letters, and therefore stop here and there. What would then happen is when all these guys are consumed, that is returned to the user as valid tokens or perhaps error characters, it could say, okay, now I have this last thing to handle, end the file. I'll return this special end the file token to the user or to the parser, which says I ran out of characters. Now it's the point to verify that you have a complete program among the tokens that have already been scanned. So that's the way this thing is handled. There's no way to say here's an end the file character, although you can sometimes simulate its effect. And I'll show you what I mean about that in a little bit. So it turns out that I could imagine having end the file be a character, but then you'd have to rely upon the user to always create a proper end the file token, presumably comprising only the end the file character, and have that returned as the very last action of a scanner. So not all scanner generators trust that. Oh, in fact, apropos to that, let me mention something that I found last time, and maybe this is a good news because you'll find your job is easier than you thought. Remember I had an example just a moment ago called ex.jlex. And of course the jlex is a suffix that says this is an input in jlex format. Now what this thing will do automatically, and it happened when I ran the build, was create a file very similar, but it's got a .java suffix. Now, the point is, you're welcome to look at this file, but you do not have to and probably should not ever go in and actually edit that generated file. Some of you may have gone in there, and I know at least one person who's looking at it and say, my gosh, this looks terrible. I've got arrays of numbers. And this person went through there and he checked out the numbers. Oh, sure enough, this must be the numeric equivalent of the ASCII character A or B or blank or whatever. And that's fine. All you're doing is verifying the scanner knows its job. The scanner generator knows its job. But it's not your job to go ahead and edit the Java any more than if you write a compiler that generates a code for an x86, for example. You typically don't go in and say, here's an x86 instruction that loads register 5. Let's change it to register 4. You could do that, but what you're doing is you're doing all the hard work that a compiler automatically does for you automatically and correctly. So you're doing the compiler's job, and you're probably doing it way worse than the compiler would do it. Similarly, your job is not to edit Java, but just to live with it, enjoy it. So think of it as being like an Amazon.com. You click a couple of buttons, and all of a sudden, this little drone comes in, and they're actually experimenting with this. It knows from GPS where your backyard is, assuming you have a backyard, and drops a little parachute type of guy and says, within 5 or 10 minutes, you got your latest book or your latest movie or whatever it is you get from Amazon right into your yard. So in this sort of situation, JLEX drops into your yard a working Java scanner, but it's not your job to go in and edit it or correct it. You're certainly welcome to go in there and look at it just to ooh and ah. And maybe if you're a developer or something, there's certainly a slight chance the generator did something silly and you have a chance of fixing it. But this is sort of for super experts and not for ordinary users. So this exists, but don't feel compelled to go ahead and look at it or use it, except indirectly by having it be compiled. And a way to recognize this is when I do a clean, one of the first things I do is remove that generated file, because I don't want the old one. The notion is you're going to fix up ex.jlex or perhaps csx.jlex, change it, correct it, add tokens, one and then another and another. Each time you do that and you run JLEX, you get a brand new ex.jlex that's bigger and better. So be clear on this. This is what this thing, if it looks hard and complex, that's good, because that means a lot of the hard work is being done by somebody else. And it's always been my feeling, hard work is always great and builds your character if it's long as you're doing it. Hard work is not build my character. My character's already been built or unbuilt, so I'll let somebody else do all the hard work and get the glory for it. I'll just sit back and enjoy the fruits of it all. Something else that turns out to be nice is when we develop our tokens, we talked a little bit about the fact, as I illustrated up here, that sometimes a scanner has to scan a bit further than it would normally expect to determine what a valid token is or not. In early programming languages, we didn't have this notion of scanning and parsing down as solid as we do now. In early languages, Fortran is certainly one of the very first successful programming languages. For those of you not experienced it, Fortran stands for Formula Translator and was used by scientists and engineers and is still used in its more recent formulations today by scientists and engineers. And they had many of the concepts back then that we use now. Not as advanced, but they still had it. So, for example, one of the famous constructs, and I wrote more than my share of this, was a do loop. A do loop is like a for loop, a while loop. What do they call it in cache? Does cache have a looping construct? What do they call it? For, while, repeat, something like that? For, spelled F-O-R. Cool. See, so some things haven't changed too much. So anyway, this would be the way they did it for an iteration. And it really isn't as strange as it might seem. What happens is, think of do as being iterate. So we call it for, they call it do. And it's not clear either of their names is all that great. They did not at that time have the notion of matching brackets or braces or so on. So what they did instead is, this would be a number on a statement. So down below, you'd have a statement guaranteed to have a number 10 on it. Excuse me? Oh, duh. I can see it. Why can't you? I always think. So something called continue, and this would essentially be the scope of the loop. J is an index, I and J, equals 1, starts at 1, and the limit is 100. And if you want, you could have a third parameter that says how you increment it. The default is one. So this is a loop that says go down to statement 10 as a loop body, start with J at 1, and iterate it all the way up to and including 10. Now, what the scanner would do, notice, is not all that much different than what our scanner would do. Do is a reserved word. 10 is an integer literal, which may be used as a statement number. This is an identifier. That's an assignment. That's an integer. A comma is a separator. We have those. And that's an integer literal. So scanning that statement would be very similar in their technology to how we do it. But here's the problem. Back in those days, they didn't have some notion of having boundaries and limitations to delimit carefully where things go. So I can write down a very similar line. The only difference is I changed a comma to a dot. And on many keyboards, a dot and a comma are either adjacent, or I think on some old key punches, they are actually on the same key, one shifted above the other. So very close together. What's interesting about this is scanned by Fortran entirely differently than what we showed above, even though there's only a very modest difference. And it turns out the difference was even more modest because in the old days, when you entered input, you did not put it on a screen. You actually had card punches. And oftentimes at a computer operation, they had a special person who was very adept at doing punching cards that would actually punch cards, and you've seen these, if not actually touched them in your hands, with the holes down the body. And what would happen is up top, they'd have a little typewriter-like device that would actually print out the characters that were typed in so that you didn't have to memorize what hole patterns represented what. But any of you who have used, I don't know if any of you have, anybody here actually used a manual typewriter that had a ribbon? A few, more than a few, okay. After a while, as the ribbon starts to wear out, characters are not particularly sharp. And it turned out it was very easy to misread a comma and a dot, one for the other. Particularly, a comma could be misread as a dot because it would be very similar and just a little bit of the ink is washed out. So what this thing would be scanned as, and you're not going to believe this, and wait till I tell you the rest of the story, this would be scanned as an identifier. Because back then they had the rule you could allow blanks embedded in an identifier. Notice that's kind of come back. Certainly in file systems, you're allowed to have files whose names are a series of words separated by blanks. You know, like my music or my video or my this or my that. You know, it's me, I guess. So this is not so strange, and it was allowed. This thing is an assignment. And they also had something else, and I don't know if Cache allows this or not, but they back then, you did not have to declare identifiers in advance. If you wanted an identifier, you got it by just naming it. So do 10J is an odd-sounding name, but hey, think of it. Our identifier syntax allows it. I could have something called do 10J. You didn't have to declare it, and what it would do is it would decide from the very first letter of the identifier whether its type was integer or floating point. And guess what? D turned out to be one of them that would be floating point. Floating point means with a decimal. It would then scan 1.100 as a fixed decimal or floating point number. And this would turn out not to be a loop iterator, but rather an assignment of a floating point value, 1.1, to a newly implicitly declared floating point variable. Okay, ho-hum, ho-hum, what's so funny about that? Well, it turns out this error was actually made. It was made in a very embarrassing situation. Namely, this was part of a control program for a rocket launched from Cape Canaveral. It was part of a program before Apollo when the United States was just first started thinking about exploring the moon. It was called Project Ranger. And you can probably Wikipedia that or Google that. And what normally would happen is when you launch a rocket, people seem to think of it as a rocket going straight up. But that's not how rockets actually work. They go straight up for a while. But what happens at some point when the rocket's up high enough? Yeah. People think, you know, that rockets go straight up, but if they went straight up, they come straight down eventually, and that's not so good. So they have something called a roll maneuver. So what happened is typically Cape Canaveral was on the Atlantic coast in, you know, in Florida, middle of Florida. It would launch up, and then it'd go into a roll program, which would roll the rocket kind of sideways, and that's how you'd put it in orbit. I can put it in orbit for a couple of orbits and then shoot it on towards the moon to test out the moon. And this statement was meant to be part of the roll program. It's an iteration. They were going to iterate and roll it. But it didn't iterate because it was not an iteration. And I don't know what their testing criteria were, but probably pretty poor, way inferior to, I'm sure, what you do here. So it turns out that this thing went up and up and up, and all of a sudden it's supposed to go into the roll program, and it didn't. Well, it turns out there's one guy at every launch that has great responsibility, and who is he or she? What does he or she do? They decide when they have to abort the launch. Remember, if it goes straight up and it doesn't roll, it comes straight down, and that's not so good. So at some point, he said, oh, this is misfiring. They push the button, kaboom, kaboom, and you get the world's greatest fireworks over the Florida coast. And that's why when they did a launch, they would say all the fishermen and commercial vessels and so on, stay out of the way just in case. So there's some poor programmer, probably from the 1960s, who is probably still paying back the cost of that missile, maybe $10 a week out of his paycheck or his retirement check until he gets however many millions of dollars paid off. So it turns out this notion of multi-character look-ahead, although we can figure out how to do it, is something we have to handle very carefully, just because sometimes we can get a very unexpected scan and parse from very tiny errors. A modern fortune does not have this problem, so it's something that's long since been fixed. So that's an example of extreme look ahead, but turns out there are other cases where we need extra look ahead. Now, what does look ahead mean? It means I have to read more characters than I expected just to figure out the context in which what I've already read is to be interpreted. One great example, something that existed in some languages, does not exist today, but something called a subrange. If you think about typically when we work with numbers and computers today, you have basically two choices. It's floating point, which means it has a decimal point and maybe an exponent, or it's an integer. But it turns out not all integers are equally good. There are some cases where I would like to say some integers are not to be allowed. So, for example, if I was doing something where I was working with the 50 states of the United States, hey, there are 50 of them, I might want to index them from 1 to 50, or I might even want to index them using an abbreviation of their names. But I would want to say, if I'm talking about the states of the Union, I don't want to have negative numbers, nor do I want to have numbers bigger than 50. I probably don't even want 0. So the way it was able to be done in some programming languages is you could give a range of integers. So in my example, I'd say 1 to 50. And this would say I'm allowed to have an integer, so I could have something like states, or state, let's say. And this might be a declaration for state in the range 1 to 50. It's got to be an integer, no fractions allowed, but I can't have 51 because we don't know what the 51st state is yet, and we don't have 0 because, unlike most brain-dead computer scientists, I don't start counting from 0. I start counting from 1. So if I'm going to say, and in fact, you see that on the coins. Remember those coins have all the various states. One of the coins had the motto, first in the Union or something. And it didn't say 0th in the Union, because being first is great, but being 0th is not so great. And anybody says, you're number 1, okay, that's fine. He says, you're a real 0. That's not so good. So this is something allowed in some languages. But here's the difficulty, namely, when I'm scanning along, I also, when I see that first decimal point, have to worry about the fact I might see something like this, which is simply a decimal fraction. So it turns out this is not so bad, but let me show you what happens. Here's an automaton that's built by a scanner generator like ours that is set up to handle two possibilities. The first possibility says I'm going to be something that's a decimal fraction. So in this particular case, I go along and be able to read a number with a decimal point in it. The other one says the bottom path, let me show right here, is the case where I have two consecutive decimal points. And those are read as this thing, and that's sometimes called the range operator, the subrange operator. It's sort of reminiscent, if you've seen mathematics, sometimes people use three dots as in ellipses, you know, yada, 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 or et cetera, et cetera. This is sort of a variation on that. It says I'm in the range from 1 to 50 in that case. So what happens is when I'm scanning along, and I see a decimal point 1, I don't know that I've seen an integer or possibly a prefix of a floating point number. I then have to read a decimal point. That still doesn't tell me which am I in. Is this part of a floating point number, or is this a subrange? Remember, things that I haven't scanned yet, I don't know about. I haven't seen them. So what I need to do is scan one more character. And if I read three characters, I can distinguish the two situations. The top one says, I'm an integer followed by a subrange. But notice what I have to do is stop with the integer, return that immediately, and buffer the two dots as part of the next token, because that's a separate token, and I haven't asked for the next token yet. In this case, I see the 1.5, and I say, oh, I know what I'm in. I'm a part of a floating point number, something like this up here. And I'll keep reading digits until I can't read anymore, and that's the end of the floating point number. So the upshot is, and it turns out you don't have to program this. This is something the scanner knows about. But again, a blessing that you don't have to worry about it, namely it's already in there, is that the token definitions will sometimes read extra characters. I showed you that one example previously about hitting end the file, where you had to run out of characters to know there were no more characters, and hence the token you've read is the correct token. Sometimes you have to read an extra character. Usually in modern languages, it's only one or two extra characters, not as many as it was with this do example, where in this particular case, to distinguish between do and do 10j, I'd have to read some blanks and all the way up to the equal to find out which it is. So in fact, actually further. So in that particular case, many characters. So this notion of having extra look ahead is something that the scanner has to be ready to anticipate. And all for your purposes, it is simply, the scanner has this rule, read as many characters as you need to make a decision. If there are two choices, as I showed you up here, between the subrange and a floating point number, read enough characters to make the choice. And if you read extra characters, which really weren't part of the token in question, like this integer literal one, just buffer the other characters. And it may be you have to have several characters buffered, but it'll go ahead and handle that. So that's the notion of what this look ahead is about. And you will see that later on when we talk about the various issues. One other thing we don't have to worry about, but sometimes people do, it's always, no matter how fast your processors are, they're not fast enough. So it's a situation there that, surprisingly, if you want a fast compiler, one of the spots unexpectedly that can slow you down is the fact that you can have a slow scanner. Turns out our generated scanners are fairly efficient, but people have actually done research on coming up with ultra-high performance scanners, and I'll talk about that in just the next slide. So it turns out these days, as things get faster, it's not a big issue, but be realistic. If I, for example, wanted to be able to compile 5,000 lines a second, it seems like a lot, but I mean 5,000 lines is not that much in a program. So we're saying if you wanted programs, except the very biggest ones, to compile almost instantaneously, and that's kind of what you hope for a system like Eclipse, where you say, okay, I'm done, save the file, compile it, give me error messages, or compile it, and let's start testing and experimenting. So in that case, if I had 5,000 lines a second, I'd have, say I had 30 characters to scan, that means I'd have to be able to have the scanner process 150,000 characters a second. Again, that's not overwhelming a lot, but it's a big enough number that if you do it sloppily, it may catch up with you. So performance considerations may be an issue. Turns out people know enough about generating quality scanners. And I'll get to some of the theory of that and why. And let me tell you about one worrisome issue that does not come up. One of the things that may have bothered you, remember I said build your scanner line by line, generate this token and that and that. So you might give a definition for token one and some regular expression, and then token two, and token three, and on and on and on. And remember, we have this rule that says the earliest token definition that matches works. If there are two definitions, one matches longer than the other, the longer. So longer is better than shorter, and if they match the same length, earlier is better than later. So you might say to yourself, okay, how's this gonna work? Well, he's gonna try pattern number one. It may work or not, remembers it. He's gonna try pattern number two, maybe it works or not, three, four, and so on. And that kind of suggests that if I go to more and more and more tokens, 50 tokens, 100, a couple of 100, it's going to get slower and slower because it's going to have to try more and more patterns. Intuitively, you may think that's the way it works, but it's not. The cool thing about this is it takes all these patterns and meshes them together into one scanning definition that runs simultaneously. So the speed of a scanner is dependent not on how many tokens you have, but rather on how many characters are in the token. because obviously you have to at least read the characters. So you'd expect if I read X, Y, Z, that would take three, let's say, units of time, whatever they are. If I read X, Y, Z, zero, that would take four units, etc. That this thing would be faster than that one only because I have to read a fewer characters. And that is, in fact, true. The speed is essentially proportional on a per token basis to the number of characters, not to the number of definitions. And that kind of sounds too good to be true, because how do you know that token definition 1 and token definition 77 don't conflict? And in fact, they may. Conflict means that they may have a partial match. This, for example, might be a reserved word, like begin. And this might be an identifier. Remember, an identifier is any letter, one or more of them. Writing this in regular expression notation, not JLEX notation. And begin matches that pattern, so they can, in fact, interfere. But it turns out, as the scanner is built, they interfere in a way that says, let's cooperate. If I see a B, you're in the running and I'm in the running, and we'll simply continue reading characters until there's a divergence. If I see an E, we're still in the running. If the next thing I see is B, E, T, bet. Oh, I would never do that. So all of a sudden, bet does not match begin, but it does match an identifier. It says BE could be part of begin, but BET for sure isn't. And therefore, it says, okay, I know the winner, and I still may have to continue scanning because there may be additional letters and or digits, and I want the longest match. But these guys cooperate in a very clever way. So even if there's many definitions that seem to conflict, they only conflict in the sense of giving the automata that recognizes these a somewhat bigger challenge. So let's see how we're doing here. We got time on this. Good. So turns out at least one definition, one scanner generator came up with something called a GLA scanner. And this is one of those things there that sometimes when something's too good to be true, you're worried about it, because I remember reading a paper about this, and this was their claim. This is a program you may or may not recognize, but I'll explain it to you. And they claimed that their generated scanner for any of the programming languages which were then current, obviously they couldn't say in future what people might decide to include, that this program, their scanner, would run faster than this program. What is this program? Well, we've pretty much gone through part of it. This is something written in C where they believe there's an end-of-file character. So it says, while the current character being processed is not end-of-file, what am I going to do? I'm going to call a standard C library called getchar that says, give me one more character. And what am I going to do with it? Nothing. I'm going to throw it away, say, give me another, give me another. So this guy is just whooshing through the file until it's end of file, and then he's done. And they're claiming that their scanner is going to run faster than this guy. Now, this is one of those things like late night TV where, you know, they come up with a super slicer dicer, and, oh, that's going to do this, and it's going to do such a great job that, you know, you'd never, ever want to use anything else again. And if you want, they'll give you two of them, just add extra postage and handling. But it turned out that these guys were not lying. They were misleading. And that's somewhat different. You know, sometimes you're allowed to mislead, even if you don't lie. So can anybody guess what the gotcha was on this? How could it be that a real honest gosh scanner, maybe something as simple as for CSX, generated very efficiently by an optimized scanner, could run faster than this sucker? After all, it's doing nothing. It's reading characters and throwing them away. And that's about as fast as you can imagine. But there was one gotcha that made it all work. And anybody makes a guess of what that is? Well, there is one thing about this loop that's slower than you would like. And that's the fact we're doing an operating system call. Now, the folklore is operating system calls can be fairly slow. And notice you're doing a lot of them because I'm doing them on a per character basis. What our generated scanner does, and what GLA for sure would do, is it does not read one character at a time from the operating system. It does something called buffering. And what buffering says is we'll read in a group of characters. There used to be magic numbers that would be in various operating systems, like 128 or 256 or 512 or 1024, some nice power of two. And you could say an IO routine that says, give me the next 512 characters, and if they're fewer than that, tell me that and give me however many you have left. And what would happen there is I would then not have to call getchar 512 times. I call some fancier version that says, get me buffer, for example, once, and now I've got as many as 512 characters, which I can then handle internally. So the overhead of calling GetShare more times than you need to turned out to be more than enough to make the generated scanner faster than this guy. But it's one of those things, you give a presentation that says, I can run faster than that, and it seems too good to be true. There was a gotcha, but it still emphasized the fact that they did a darn fine job of making fast scanners. Speed of your scanner doesn't matter because you're not generating it. And it turns out, unless you did something really weird, you're not going to make the scanner very slow. It's going to be more than fast enough. So now we get to an issue which I was talking at the beginning of class is interesting, namely, at this stage, we ought to be able to handle all valid tokens. In fact, now's a good time for me to stop, take a sip of soda, and see, are there any questions remaining about the tokens that you have to handle, about how to handle them, how do we do this, how do we do that? Because at this stage, I still haven't talked about how to handle certain kinds of errors. Many of them are pretty trivial, some of them are not. But beyond errors, all valid tokens, you should now have some notion of how, in regular expressions and in JLEX, you go about programming them. So, yeah.
So when we exclude unprintable characters, we're also excluding tab and
numa. Right, those are unprintable. Right, those are considered unprintable. The only invisible character that's considered printable is blank.
The question is in the character literal, we talked last time about
what the recommendation is, when you're printing them out, you've converted to a raw character. That was a little bit of a gotcha on my part, because you don't have to do that on strings. Thank goodness, believe me. If you had to convert the entire context of a string, taking away the quotes and stripping away all the escapes, that's nastier. But now you have to take the character and put it in a form a human reads. And you were right on the button, namely, a tab and a new line are not easily readable by a human. If you do the obvious sort of thing, and you have a character which I did as a tick, new line, tick. If I give you that as part of my input, and I bet you if I don't, the TA does, you're going to take that and change it from four characters to one internal invisible character, the new line character. That's what's sitting in your token. And now you're going to do debugging and testing. You say, oh, what is this? I found a char, this is a character literal. So it's a char literal or whatever we call it. And typically, I recommend you put in parentheses what you found. The easiest thing to do is simply print out the character. But now you're going to have one of two surprises. Namely, this close paren is going to be in the next line, very similar to what I did with the quoted string. Or the close paren may be farther to the right than you expected because the tab got expanded to mucho characters instead of a single character. So my recommendation is on these two, you have to undo the conversion from the escaped form, you went to the unescaped form, the internal form, and now you could go back. So when you're printing these, you say, are you one of the two magic characters? All the rest of them, even backslash and double quote, you really don't need to escape them because in the context, it's going to be clear what they are. But in the case of a tab and a new line, you can't see the darn guys. So what I would recommend is go set if your new line, a tab, print out the two characters, backslash T, a new line, backslash N. And that'll solve that problem. But you're actually spot on, and it's a tiny bit of a flavor of going from this escape to unescaped form. Internally, strings want to be characters, including unprintables. But externally, people can't read them properly. And for debugging, testing, whatever, you sometimes have to put them in escaped form just so that they're readable. Right, exactly. Those are two that we dwell on, but there's a lot more of them. And back, I can find it, but I actually gave you a little character class that represented all the unprintables. It was from octal 0 to octal 37. Those are all the unprintables below blank and octal 177. This is a definition, and you can write it down pretty readily, namely, and this is a starting point, so it's from octal if I wanted to write down in a succinct form that JLEX would like, all the unprintables, there's a way of doing that. And you're absolutely right. That includes the invisible new line and the invisible tab as among a lot of unprintables. So the tab and the new line only get priority because they're important enough that people use them routinely. If you look like at the full Java definition, particularly for the scanner, there's other escapes besides tab and new line for other unprintables that people may need. I think, for example, I think backslash G is allowed, and that's the bell character. I'd have to double check. I think it's backslash G. I'm not positive. But there's something, because the bell character is something that when you print it, it also activates a sound on your screen. So sometimes when you have an answer printed out, you'll go bing, bing, bing. So if somebody's alert to the fact that the program's completed. Somebody said one of his applications was going to finish sometime this evening, and it might sound like the world is ending or something. So it's a variation on that. Other points? Okay, so let's go on and talk about error handling. At first you say to myself, this is silly. Scanning is basic. It's character by character. But notice if you're not careful on certain circumstances, you're going to get that problem I showed at the beginning of class, namely that you have one error. In this case, it was a quoted string that tried to cross a line boundary. It's an easy error. It's not obvious to someone who's not an experienced programmer that that might not be a reasonable thing to do. We say it is. Most languages do. Again, because it's not clear when you cross the line boundary how many blanks and tabs you have. So it's a case of you're not sure what you're getting even when you're reading it. And there's sort of a theory that reading the entire source of a program ought to allow a person to predict precisely what the program is going to do. That's how you debug, after all. You say, this is what the definition says it should do, and it's not doing it, so apparently the definition's in contradiction with my expectation. So in that particular case, but we want to be able to tell users succinctly, not that the double quote and the entire content of the quoted string on the first line were all bad. Yes, they were, but they weren't individually bad. It's just that someone had the notion of making a composite token and they messed up. So we'd like something to talk about that. So we'll talk about that as a harder problem. But the easier problem is basically, I see a bad character. And there's lots of them that the only way you'll handle them is you'll find out they don't begin any valid token. I think question mark is one of those. We don't have so rich a language we use every last character on the keyboard. I don't think question mark is used as a token. Now, it can be inside of a token, like a comment or a quoted string or a quoted character. But notice in that case, that's not a token. It's part of a token. So if I see one of these, how am I going to find out that it's illegal? Well, we'll talk about that. But basically, what I recommended, and I actually had on that little example I showed, is after all the valid token definitions, T1, T2, blah, 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 you have something that matches one single character. So if nobody else wants it, I'll take it. But of course, what I'll do is I'll go ahead and take it to the backyard and shoot it. So in this case, I put parens around it because the dot is so small, it's sometimes easy to miss. Oh, duh, I keep doing it, don't I? So in the example I had at the beginning of class, as the very last line, I had a dot. You don't need to put parens around it. I just do it to make it read a little more. And it matches this one. And then the effect here is to print out some sort of error message. And the easiest sort of thing is illegal character skipped or something like that. And here it is, and you show the character. If you wanted to, you could also show line and column number, but I'm not sure for our purposes that's needed. Just something that says, nobody else wanted this guy. If I don't match him, what's going to happen is he's going to be unmatched by anybody, and JLEX is going to call that a termination error. You gave it a character, and you didn't tell it what to do. It doesn't know what to do. Its job is to only follow your instructions. So it's a situation where it would terminate your run. You don't want that. So you'd print out some sort of error message. And in many cases, that's just fine. It may be the case you're deeper in before you realize something is illegal. And in those particular cases, it may be a situation where ABC was legal, but AB was not. So it might be you've read A and B in expectation of a C, but it's not there. So you might have to say, hey, this is illegal. You can go ahead and give error messages one character at a time, or you can try to group all the characters and delete them all at once. It's a question of which is easier to do. In JLEX, it's easier to simply have the very first character that it read, call that an error, and delete it and go on. except for the case of things like runaway strings, you have to handle reasonably well, reasonably differently, I should say. So it's easy to throw away the first character. That's what the scanner will routinely do with this thing, and just start scanning again. You could try to match longer sequences, but remember, you don't want to match an arbitrarily long sequence because you may steal valid characters and throw them away. So since it's the case that lexical errors typically begin with an illegal character to start, throwing away a single character is fine, and that is something I'll expect all of you to have. So if you haven't put it in yet, at some point, you're going to have some line at the bottom that matches a single character. By the way, this matches a single character other than new line. Why am I not worrying about new line? Well, remember, new lines are already included as something called white space. Blanks, tabs, and new lines, which are kind of invisible but separate tokens, are consumed quietly. They're not errors, and they're simply thrown away. That is, the scanner does not return a token. It simply resumes scanning after the blanks and tabs and new lines. Oops, I'm a tad over. So this is a good place. Yeah, this is a good place to stop. And what we'll do is we'll have a 15-minute break. It's now 6:30 according to this, and we'll start again at 6:45 for our second hour.